Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Ed Alera of the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and Michael Ankuma of Bank of America. We've got a fantastic lineup of guests for you today, including Mike Shelton, chairman of EMCOR Government Services, Dudley Berthold, president, Griffin Technologies, Bruce Case, president of Case Design and Remodeling, and Myra Ruiz McPherson, president and CEO of Ruiz McPherson Communications. So let's get started. I'd like to introduce to you our first guest. His name is Mike Shelton, and Mike's the chairman of EMCOR Government Services. So Mike, welcome to the show. And what is EMCOR Government Services?
Our company provides facilities maintenance and base operation services for the military, and has expanded out to government agencies such as the State Department and the like. We also do construction services for the Corps of Engineers.
Facilities maintenance and base operations, what does that mean?
That means we do the, as they say, the ash and trash. We take care of buildings. We take care of a base for example, the Guantanamo, where the prisoners are held.
Yes.
We do all of the base maintenance for that entire base.
You mentioned Walter Reed in the green room. Tell us about what you do for Walter Reed.
We have all of the facilities maintenance support for the entire complex, which means we take care of making sure the electrical, the air conditioning, the plumbing, all of the things that are essential for it to run and make sure that that the patients are constantly comfortable.
Yeah, I'm just an average everyday American guy. Why is that important to me?
Because your leaders go there for medical treatment.
Including the president.
Starting with the president and going through Congress.
Wow.
And you should not be worried that their medical care is going to be in any way affected by bad facilities.
Yeah, we appreciate that. It's important work. Thank you. How big or small is EMCOR?
EMCOR is the group that we work for is about $6.3 billion. We're a principal subsidiary of that. And we have probably 4,000 employees spread throughout the United States and overseas.
So EMCOR Government Services was founded when?
Actually, about 2006. We started out as a small part of another part of the company, and then we branched off and became our own entity about 2006.
Now, why are you the only person on the planet qualified to be chairman of this company?
Well, I think that I would say that's because of the neat set of skill sets that I developed over time.
One in particular.
Which is I make hard decisions and I solve difficult problems.
Yeah. Tell us about solving problems. Where and why did that first show up?
I think it kind of is an offshoot of the military. I spent 34 years in the Navy, in the Civil Engineer Corps, and throughout that time I went through progressively more difficult jobs where I was sent to solve problems.
Yeah, and we're going to ask you about some of those a little bit later. Where are you from?
Kind of all over. My dad was a military man. He was in the Navy for an entire career.
How did your grandmother describe it?
I was drugged from one side of the world to the other.
But your grandparents were not?
No, they were farmers from Central Illinois. They both had farms that they worked with and lived the typical dirt farmer life.
Well, if you were drugged from one side of the world to the next, why did you seek a military background and career?
I think there are two reasons. One is I got used to moving every two or three years, and it wasn't a big deal for me. The second was my dad told me that I was going to go to the Naval Academy because he wasn't going to pay for college.
You mean your dad suggested that you might someday want to consider that?
No, I mean he said, you're going to the Naval Academy, period.
Well, that's not all he said, though. There was something that came after the period, right? It was the word free?
Free. I'm not paying for you to go to school.
And he was serious?
Yes, he was.
Did you know he was serious?
Yes, I did.
So what'd you do about that?
Well, I kind of put up with it until I was in high school, and then it became time for me to get more serious about it. And among the things that happened, I had to take a physical, and I did it in a naval hospital. And while I was taking it, the doctor asked me what I was going to do, where I was going to go to college. I said, the Naval Academy. He said, no, you're not, because you can't pass the eye test.
What was the problem?
I was nearsighted.
And that is relevant why?
Relevant to the Naval Academy?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Okay.
As I said, we were talking earlier, and I said, bureaucrats have basically, you know, run my life because I've had to deal with rules that made no sense and get around them.
But you've had a focus because you then qualify for the military academy, which is not easy to do. You know, that focus is...
Yeah. I think it focused me in that my dad focused me. When I went home and told him I couldn't go to the Naval Academy, he said, find one you can go to.
So what'd
and
you do?
And it turned out that the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, I could pass the eye test for that, and I was fortunate enough to get an appointment to go there.
There was also some sort of fine print that somebody read, which created an opportunity for you, did it not?
It did. Again, the bureaucrats, this time in the Army, said that I could not. I wanted to be in the Corps of Engineers. For bureaucratic reasons, I couldn't be in it because of the quota system there. And my dad found a bureaucratic rule that said if your father had served a career in any service, as you graduate from West Point, you could go into that service. And then he acquainted me with the Navy Civil Engineer Corps, and specifically the Seabees, the construction battalions, which is what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And that's what I did.
For those people who don't know what that is, the Corps of Engineers and the Seabees, what is it?
Well, basically, they're the construction arm of the Army and the Navy. And they're responsible for the construction, maintenance, and repair of bases. And specifically, the Seabees are the combat construction force of the Navy who principally support the Marines.
So you were in combat?
Yes, I was.
Tell us about combat. Tell us about one time. What's it like?
Well, it's kind of indescribable. I guess what my introduction to combat was a shell missing my head by 6 inches and hitting the guy next to me. I was 22 years old.
Where were you?
And I was in the I Corps of Vietnam during the Tet Offensive in 68. And all of a sudden, a lot of people are shooting at us and trying to kill us, where 5 seconds before that, it was just a everyday, ordinary, we just got done eating. And that brings you into a whole another world. I think the most significant thing I can tell people, it's hard for people to understand, is that the randomness of war, you know, why did he hit the guy next to me and not me? This is something that troubles people, the kids coming back from Afghanistan. Why did this guy get killed and that guy didn't get killed?
Did you ever ask yourself that question?
Sure, all the time.
What answer did you come up with?
There really is no answer. I kind of say luck is important. It's better to be lucky than good.
Yeah.
Well, you've managed a company through the economic downturn, which is pretty tough on many people. I take it you feel your military background prepared you for that.
I think so. In a couple of the biggest part of it is the ability to make a decision that has to be made. One of the things that I've observed in both in the military and since I've left the military is people have a hard time making decisions, particularly hard decisions. And as I mentioned before, there's only two kinds of decisions to me, ones that get people killed and all the rest. And that sounds pretty harsh. I learned it in combat. But the bottom line of it is every other decision besides the ones that get people killed, you can fix. They may be painful, they may be embarrassing, but you can fix it. So not making a decision doesn't do you anything.
If I can get back to Mike's point to begin with, were you drawn to problem fixing, or were you thrown into it? You mentioned you wanted to be an engineer. Was that part of wanting to fix and build things, which is sort of the trajectory that your career has taken?
To be honest with you, I thought engineering was easy because the answers were there. I mean, you just kind of found them. I think the business about being drawn to these kind of things, and how did I get into these jobs where I was doing it, I think people saw that I was not afraid to make a decision. A lot of people are paralyzed, they can't do it. And then once I made decisions, then they started to be right, and they looked right, then I get progressively harder jobs.
You use the word paralyzed. I've often wondered, because I've never been in this situation myself, maybe some of our listeners haven't either, when you were there on the battlefield and the shells are flying, are you scared and dealing with it, or are you completely absent of fear because you're focused? What's going on inside, and how do you deal with it?
I think it's a function of really everything that's happened to you up to that point in life. In my particular case, the training I had and everything else focused me on what do I need to do to get out of this situation. You're scared, there's no doubt about it. There's a lot of noise and stuff going on. But I think if you crystallize it, you've got people who are looking at you and expecting you to do something.
And to bring that forward to managing the company today, do you use the same lessons and the same decision-making process when you're in a crisis in the company?
Yes, and basically that process is pretty simple. I start out with what's the worst thing that can happen if I make the wrong decision? And since it's not going to be somebody being killed, it's pretty easy.
Your dad told you to join the Navy, and you did. What does he think about his son?
Well, unfortunately, he's not with us anymore, but he was very proud that I went into the CBs and all that, and he followed my career. And he was a Pearl Harbor, Battle of Midway, all the big battles of World War II. So he had his combat experiences, and so he related a lot with what I had done.
Yeah. Would you give us the web address, please, for MCOR Government Services?
It's www.mcorgroup.com.
I want to make sure everybody gets it. Would you spell it for us, especially the MCOR?
Okay, www.emcorgroup.com.
MCOR Group. Thank you very much, Mike. We've been speaking with Mike Shelton. Mike's the chairman of MCOR Government Services. I'd like to thank my two co-hosts, Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and Michael Ancuma of Bank of America for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders just like Mike, and we will be back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is?
John Tittle.
John, who are you with?
I'm with Convene.
What is Convene?
Convene is a national organization of CEO peer group, roundtable, CEO roundtable, Christian business leaders who come together to help each other deal with their business issues.
How do they help each other?
In forum days where we get together for a day, we work together around what's really going on in a trusted, safe environment where you can bring issues that you might not have any other place that you can really talk it through.
When you say safe and trusted, what do you mean?
Well, let me give you an example. One of our members came with an issue that they needed to, their starting place was, I think I need to restructure the positions in my board. Yeah. And so we explored that issue. At the end of the discussion, I asked the group, so what's the real issue? Key insight. Where we started was not the real issue. It actually was the people weren't performing, and the group said, you don't need to change the position descriptions. You need to fire those folks and get the people who'll do what you need to do. This is not an issue that this person would have been able to work with her board, right?
Right.
So took that recommendation, worked that through, huge, huge impact on the organization.
Who's a good candidate for a peer group like this?
Somebody who's in the hot seat. You have to find that balance of strategy, performance, delivery, people, all the rest of it. And you're ready, you're trying to drive things to make things different, and you realize you need some help.
How do we get a hold of you, John?
ConveneNow.com.
ConveneNow.com. We've been speaking with John Tittle of Convene, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce.
This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Michael Ancuma of the Bank of America and Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. And we're excited to introduce to you our next guest. His name is Bruce Case, and Bruce is the president of Case Design and Remodeling. So, Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And tell us, what is Case Design and Remodeling?
Case Design Remodeling is a home renovation firm. We do anything from small home care, home repair needs, all the way up to large multi-story additions.
So tell us about one cool house project or remodeling that you did recently.
Most recent one, it was a larger project downtown in Adams Morgan where we retrofitted the whole inside of a house. So from the outside, the house looked the same, basically a row house. Yeah. Inside took it from the 1920s all the way up to very contemporary high-end glass staircase, so on and so forth.
Wow, that's cool. How many projects do you guys do a year, let's say?
In the D.C. market, we do about 2,000 a year, and we also do another 2,000 or so home remodeling projects in other parts of the U.S.
Got it. Okay, and the company was founded when?
1961.
And I want you to explain something. In the green room, you said, quote, "We inspire and we seek to touch their soul," end quote. Wow. What does that mean to you?
It's a lot more exciting, I think, and challenging to do that than just home renovation. So for me, we want to get to the emotional side with our homeowners and with our team members also, because replacing faucets, adding space to people's home, fixing their kitchens and bathrooms is great to live in. But we're in a service business. We're in people's homes. We're in their domain. Yeah. And we want to make it, while we're there, special, but also something they can look back on for many years.
So replacing a faucet, not to be too extreme here, can touch someone's soul.
I think it sounds funny, but I think it can. Because the faucet itself, it's a new faucet, great, whatever. But when somebody shows up at the house and shows up clean cut, on time, shakes your hand, looks you in the eye, does the job right, maybe does a little extra thing while they're there, pats the dog, does different. All of a sudden, you've made a new connection, a relationship, right beyond just replacing the faucet.
Wow, completely agree. How long have you been the president?
I've been the president for about 4 years now.
And you took over from whom?
Prior president named Mark Richardson, and it was just a part of the succession plan.
All right. Mark Richardson?
Mark.
His name is not Case.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. Who founded the company?
My dad, Fred Case, founded the company, and then he lives in Maine now.
Okay.
Is still involved in the business from a high-level strategic perspective, but then Mark was one of the presidents. There was a lady before him named Polly Evans who was a president also, so there's been a couple presidents to sort of deal with the day-to-day.
So you had a Case running the company and then several non-family members running the company. Now a Case is running the company again.
Correct.
Is there a burden that you feel because your name is on the door and your father founded the company?
There is a burden, and it sounds maybe funny for some people to hear that, because there's wonderful parts to having a pride, and so on and so forth with it. But the burden for me comes in with upholding standards, because when your name's on the door, it's not just, oh, I want my name to have a good name, but it's also a real emotional component. I have an image in my mind of how I want the brand, the reputation to be, and it's sometimes hard to meet that.
Tell us about growing up. Dad founded the company in 61. I'm assuming you were a little boy.
I was born in 68.
Okay.
So he got it going before.
All right. Well, what was it like growing up with Dad as the owner of the company?
He would eat dinner with us, work all day. He'd come home for dinner, so I'd see him. And dinner time was a real thing at our family. We'd all sit around the table and share stories from the day. And then he would go back downstairs and do paperwork all evening. So he put full long, long hours in.
So were you on site as a young boy?
Yes. Yeah. I was not on site working. I started working when I was 12, which I'm still not quite sure if that's a legal age to start working or not.
Did you get paid?
I did. Actually, I got paid pretty well. It was competitive. I was actually making pretty good money in the summers. But before that, I wasn't working, quote unquote, but I would show up on the jobs. I'd ride with him. I'd work around the house with him a lot.
So was that fun or was it a pain because, hey, everybody else is out playing baseball and I got to work with
him? Oh,
I
loved it.
Did you?
I loved it.
What'd you love about it?
I love manual labor is one thing, and that's, again, maybe sounds funny to say, but I just love getting my hands dirty, and so that was a way to do that and get paid to do it.
We live in, obviously, an information economy now. What does it feel like to do manual labor? What does it feel like to you to get your hands dirty? What does it feel like?
To me, it feels like real work. I mean, to me, that I feel like I'm really working when I'm getting into things, and also there's a sense of accomplishment. If I'm digging a ditch in an hour, I've got the ditch dug. I can look down and see that the ditch is dug. When I'm reading emails and dealing with all that, which I have to deal with, certainly sure. in my role now, it's less of a feeling of accomplishment.
Any siblings?
I have one brother, and then I have two half sisters because my parents divorced.
Do they share in this dig ditching?
In my perspective, not quite as much. My brother actually always wanted to be in the business. He wanted to be an architect. He went for school for construction management, but he ended up in IT. So I think he pursued a different angle. And
with your name on the door, do the people who work for you resent that? Do they feel you were given this, or how have you earned their respect?
Oh, they all love me. Are you kidding? No, seriously. I that's a great question.
The switchboard is lighting
yeah,
up.
Yeah, I think you'd have to ask them. I think that'd be but I feel I have to earn it every day. I made a mistake once when we used to have Christmas parties, holiday parties, when I was growing up, when I was young, at our house. So we'd have the company was smaller to my dad's house. And I would carry the coats up and down the stairs. And I made the mistake one time. A lady wasn't being real nice to me, one of the employees, and I was young. I was maybe 8, 9, something like that. And I said, my dad's going to fire you if you're not nice to me. And I've never made that mistake ever again because Dad pulled me aside and, you know, explained. And from that day, I really learned that, you know, you have to earn it each and every day.
Wow. Let's go back to Dad in the basement. You talked about going down into the basement and building things. Tell us more.
We would go downstairs. We had a big basement, very disorganized. I mean, you know, tools everywhere. Some tools were hundreds of years old. Some were brand new. And we'd go down, and he'd say, what do you want to build today, Bruce? And I'd look at it, and I was young, you know, again, maybe 7, 8, something like that, a little bit older. And I'd say a cow or a boat or whatever. And we'd get scraps of not just wood but of metal. He wouldn't throw anything away and pull it together. And we'd build different things and come up with these creations. And it was magic as a young child to be able to take something from nothing to.
I mean, it sounds so fantastic. Why'd you leave for Boston after college to become an insurance broker?
I wanted to sow my own oats. I wanted to nothing. I love my dad. I respect my dad. But I just wanted to get out from under his shadow, so to speak, and just sort of see what the world was about, see what I wanted to do in life. Wanted to do in terms of a career, because honestly, even though I loved the sawdust and I loved the business, I wasn't sure that I always wanted to do it. Number one. And number two is, you know, I wanted to be away from my dad. And again, I love him. It's just when you're under him, I wanted to get my own personality, my own career.
So you were building stuff in your apartment?
Yeah.
And how'd that go?
For me, it went great. I loved it. But for my neighbors, not so good. Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah, I would go to the – I'd take a taxi because I lived in Boston, didn't have a car. I'd take a taxi to the hardware store, which – There weren't Home Depots and right. things, so I would go to this weird hardware store and buy wood and get my tools and build it in the apartment, and neighbors would, and I'd build it at respectable hours, you know, not in the middle of the night. It'd be 2 o'clock on a Saturday in the afternoon, and I'm pounding away. They weren't so thrilled. So eventually I knew I had to get back to the business.
In what position did you come back, or what enticed you to come back?
What enticed me, number one, was the sawdust in the blood is what I call it. Yeah. I knew I had to build things. I knew I had to be part of creating things. I knew I had to be. Number two was I was in insurance brokerage when I dealt with commercial insurance packages, and I wanted to be involved with people in an area that meant more to them and to what their lives were, and certainly working in homes is part of that. That was a second reason. The third for me was the industry, because the remodeling industry is fairly, even though it's been around a long time, it's very fragmented business. There's generally a lack of business professionalism, even those great craftsmen. So there was an opportunity, I felt, to come back and bring some real professionalism and some business attributes to it.
So it's sort of a two-pronged question. You mentioned earlier you wanted to get away, or initially away from Dad and from under his shadow, but you sort of came back home, if I could put it that way. And then the other thing is, Now that he's, even though he's more at a strategic level and you're more, I guess, operational or tactical, how do you work together?
So right. It's a great question. I did, you're right, you caught me. I did come back to under his shadow, but I feel like I've got my own shadow, so to speak, now, so that, you know, certainly I'm under his, but I've got my own. But in terms of how we do the dance together, and I do feel like it's a dance, I feel like at the end of the day, he's my dad. Okay, so I can sit here and pretend to say, oh, I lead the dance sometimes, and he leads it. Frankly, he's my dad, so that's the reality of the situation. But I'll bring, I hope, a different spice to the discussions. And what we talk about, he and I, is strategic things. He does not get into the day-to-day things. He stays at a high level, almost like the Titanic. He's looking out for those glaciers. He's looking out for opportunities, which is actually is very helpful, because I get into the day-to-day and, you know, tactical issues. And I'm trying to look out for those things, but he swoops in and he'll say, this is a hot issue and this is a hot issue, and what are you doing about it? Or I'll say, I disagree, or I'm working on it. So,
well, as a tactical issue, most people who have to deal with remodeling have to deal with the lack of timeliness or the space age and quality of the artisans they deal with. How do you deal with your people and lead them to business professionalism?
Lead, you mean our team members? How do
yes,
we have them
yes,
be professional?
Yes.
Yeah, that good question. That's probably one of the areas that is most challenging, because they're all over the we're in the DC area, let's say. We're doing 2,000 projects in a given year. They're all over the place. So we've got to do a lot of training, but also longevity of time in the company is critical.
Yeah. Final question. Tell us about your daughter. Mm-hmm. And sort of doing with her what your dad did with you.
My daughter's 9, and her name's Olivia. Fantastic. I'm glad you bring her up. She brings a smile to my face. Well, to my earlier discussion about my dad, so my daughter and I, Olivia, will go down, and I'll take her down and say, what do you want to build today? And that's emotional for me, because it brings back to what my dad and I used to do, and she loves it. And I don't, you know, it's recurring that theme.
Yeah. Would you give us the web address for Case Design and Remodeling, please?
Sure. It's www.casedesign.com.
So Case, just like it sounds,
yep.
CASEdesign.com.
Yep, exactly.
Great. We've been speaking with Bruce Case. Bruce is the president of Case Design and Remodeling. I'd like to thank my two co-hosts, Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and Michael Ancuma of the Bank of America, for helping me with the interview today. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders just like Bruce. And we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Larry Fox.
Larry, who are you with?
The Values Group.
What is the Values Group?
It's a company dedicated to creating business plans.
What type of business plans? Something special about your business plans?
Yes, we're very practical. We say we're practical and tactical, and that leads to success.
Well, what does that mean, practical and tactical?
It's one thing to say you're strategic. It's more important from a bank's perspective or an investor's perspective that you know how to accomplish a mission. That's tactical.
Yeah. Give us an example of a success story.
Easy example, we recently had a company that came to us seeking a $5 million loan. It had been turned down by 8 banks. After we did its business plan, it received 5 offers and actually could have gotten a 6th.
So tell us how they could have gotten the 6th.
The 6th bank asked for the newest economic information, and the company, by the time it had assembled that, said, literally, who cares? We've already got 5 offers.
So they went from 0 to 8 to 6, potentially 6 for 6.
Yes.
How did you do that? Like, what's the secret sauce to what you do?
The secret sauce is we persuaded all the banks that this company's business had an unlimited opportunity or future.
You love doing this kind of stuff, don't you?
Absolutely.
Why?
Makes me a lifelong learner, and I like to help people.
So how does a business or a future entrepreneur get a hold of you?
www.thevaluesgroupllc.com.
So that's values plural.
Yes.
Valuesgroupllc.com.
Yes.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Larry Fox of The Values Group. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and Michael Ancuma of Bank of America. And we're thrilled to introduce to you our next guest. His name is Dudley Berthold, and he is the president of Griffin Technologies. So, Dudley, welcome to the show. And tell us, what is Griffin Technologies?
We're an engineering services firm that predominantly is focused on national security support. We're an above-the-line company that only supports the government, not the industry, in that service. And our primary focus is to help them build major acquisition weapon systems, overseeing the design and engineering of those systems.
Is there a particular branch of the military that you work with?
We're predominantly Navy. We were founded inside that market, and today that is the biggest share of the work that we're focused on.
Are you at liberty to tell us maybe what an example of a weapon system that you helped develop?
Basically all ship classes across the board, so everything from the new future aircraft carrier CVN 78 class through DDG 1000, all that effort associated with that design.
That sounds like a lot of guys' dreams, you know, weapons for aircraft carriers. Is that what it feels like?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we do it from, we got naval arcs all the way down to technicians down in the shipyards supporting the government in that effort.
Wow. And how big or small is Griffin Technologies by whatever measure?
We're about 700 people, about $1 million or $100 million of revenue.
Yeah, big company. And you've been the president for... Wow. How long now?
7 months.
7 months. Congratulations. So January 2012.
Okay. I actually joined Griffin back in 2003 after retiring from the Navy.
Okay. And you are the president. Why? Why you?
I've been there several years, obviously. And Pam Braden, who is the CEO of the company, basically founded a company that has a culture that... it kind of evolves, and her vision is kind of let the cream rise to the top and not nail it down too soon. So you're working inside an environment with a bunch of professionals, and I think discernment maybe might be a skill set I bring to the game and helping weave our way through an evolving organization.
Okay. All right. So Mr. Humility, because I know you don't like talking about yourself, you described yourself as a coach. When I asked you the question in the green room, why you said, well, I'm a coach, and we look for coaches, not dictators. What does that mean?
Well, I think inside Griffin, Griffin is mostly made up of coaches and players. And so I am coached as well as try to coach in evolving to meeting the needs of our various clients.
So the president of this particular company, at any rate, acts as a coach?
Very much so.
That's very interesting. So we'll ask you more about it later. Where are you from?
I'm from Kentucky.
Where in Kentucky?
Yeah, I'm from a little city called Ratcliff, which is right beside Fort Knox. My dad was a government civil service servant himself, as well as part of the Kentucky National Guard when I was growing up.
Tell us about Mom and Dad.
Okay. Mom and Dad, they were married real young. There was five kids. We were married in Louisville. He was still in high school. She actually dropped out of high school to start raising the kids. And they were very much team players.
Yeah. Before we go any further, married at a very young age, and how did the marriage do?
It did great. They stayed married until my mom passed away several years ago.
And that was how many years of marriage?
It's like 48.
Wow, that's fantastic. Right. Okay, so you're in Kentucky, mom and dad married at a very young age. Tell us more.
They were very much team players. Of course, they had a team of their own. There was five of us kids going everywhere, and I was number two in that list. And so it was kind of survival. But there was a culture inside the house. My dad, he went to work in the morning, came home for dinner, then turned around and went back to work. But the thing that we did every day was sit down at the dinner table and ate as a family. But mom was running the show, I would say, because dad was gone the majority of the time. Being in the guard, he was gone most of the weekends as well. I mean, he was a weekend warrior kind of guy.
Well, you mentioned something in the green room. You aspired to more. Can you embellish that a bit?
There's this sense of never being satisfied. And knowing that we can do more and accomplish more individually and as a group, and even at Griffin now. Back in the day, I can remember coming downstairs. We lived in the house. There were four or five of them that lived. All of us lived upstairs, and it was in the morning. And I had a paper route, and I went and delivered paper before I went to high school every day. And of course, my mom was always up, and So inside the living room, my dad was in there on the floor, paper spread all over the place. He had something he had to do for the guard, and I know he was up all night. And she says, if you want to succeed, that's what you got to do, son. And, of course, I wasn't doing very good in school in those days. And so I kind of turned to, and life's changed. And everything that you do during my time in the Navy was all about getting the job done. Yeah. And that was always the focus, and the same way today.
So with that focus on work and getting the job done in the Navy, you probably waited a long time to get married?
No.
Okay. Tell us
more. I kind of followed Mom and Dad in that lead. I actually, I guess that's what you do in Kentucky. My wife and I went to high school together, so we essentially got married right out of high school.
Yeah.
She went to work, I went to school. Thought a little bit about joining the Army back in that day. That was back in the Vietnam era.
Yeah.
Convinced her to work extra hard so I could go to school. And, of course, I worked at nighttime. And so we've pretty much been team players since then.
Yeah. You ended up on a nuclear ship, did you not?
Yes. So I finished ROTC program at University of Louisville, went in the Navy, was a surface warfare guy. Went off to nuclear power school, and then spent the rest of my time in that arena for several years.
And there was something that interrupted your career while on the nuclear.
Yeah, when I was in that pipeline, I actually ended up getting a little cancer, and so I had went off and took care of that. And that was back in 1986. And so it was, it was a forced career change out of that pipeline.
You make it sound like it was just a little fly in the ointment. Was it really no big deal?
I guess it was a big deal. I just didn't recognize it as one. I didn't even believe I had it. It's one of those deals that you just don't want to believe.
Yeah.
And I was too stubborn to be really worried about it. But I had to go through the whole deal of radiation, having surgery, and limb do. Is what you do when you have a medical situation. They couldn't send me back to sea, so they put you in a limited status. And then I worked myself a set of orders to get a different job. It was still career enhancing to me. Yeah. And then I went from there to be basically an engineering duty officer and acquisition professional.
So you use the word survival also. So you've managed to survive a variety of atmospheres.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm still here.
Is that a Kentucky thing, or is that a Dudley thing?
I think it's a Kentucky thing. Ironically enough, I have several friends that are from Kentucky that are in, even here. I got a guy from Kentucky that worked for me in the Navy that's now at Griffin. And so I think there is there's a work ethic. And I think most Kentuckians bring to the game, and I don't know what that is, but I guess we're born with it.
Which leads me to the question I was discussing in the green room about what you've learned, what lessons you brought from the Navy over to your in your new position, or what lessons you believe you'll carry forward in the way things are run and how you intend to run the company.
I think it's there's things that's got to be done, and you obviously cannot do them yourself. It takes teamwork, and it takes getting the right person on the right effort to get things done. And so working your way through that, focusing the people, being the coach, getting the strategy together, and pushing that on down the road is something that you do inside the Navy every day.
Well, do you think you learned anything from your disease and dealing with that that's helped you lead people?
Well, I guess, even when I had that disease, I can remember them coming in the hospital room and confronting me with, you got a decision to make. Do you really want to stay in the Navy? You don't have to stay in the Navy no more. And I remember thinking about that. I even looked at some different jobs at that time, believe it or not. And I decided I wanted to stay in the Navy, and that's exactly what I did. But I didn't focus on that. I had aspirations. That didn't turn me to be worrying about the immediate moment, which maybe I should have a little bit more, but I mean, maybe I shouldn't have, because I didn't. And here I am, you know, I don't know, 20 plus years later, and still kicking.
Yeah. Would you give us the web address for Griffin Technologies, please, Dudley?
www.griffinlc.com.
Spell Griffin for us.
GRYPHONLC.com.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Dudley Berthold. Dudley's the president of Griffin Technologies. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Michael Ancuma of the Bank of America and Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders just like Dudley, and we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Larry Fox.
Larry, who are you with?
The Values Group.
What is the Values Group?
It's a company dedicated to creating business plans.
What type of business plans? Something special about your business plans?
Yes, we're very practical. We say we're practical and tactical, and that leads to success.
Well, what does that mean, practical and tactical?
It's one thing to say you're strategic. It's more important from a bank's perspective or an investor's perspective that you know how to accomplish a mission. That's tactical.
Yeah. Give us an example of a success story.
Easy example, we recently had a company that came to us seeking a $5 million loan. It had been turned down by 8 banks. After we did its business plan, it received 5 offers and actually could have gotten a 6th.
So tell us how they could have gotten the 6th.
The 6th bank asked for the newest economic information, and the company, by the time it had assembled that, said, literally, who cares? We've already got 5 offers.
So they went from 0 to 8 to 6, potentially 6 for 6.
Yes.
How did you do that? Like, what's the secret sauce to what you do?
The secret sauce is we persuaded all the banks that this company's business had an unlimited opportunity or future.
You love doing this kind of stuff, don't you?
Absolutely.
Why?
Makes me a lifelong learner, and I like to help people.
So how does a business or a future entrepreneur get a hold of you?
www.thevaluesgroupllc.com.
So that's values plural.
Yes.
Valuesgroupllc.com.
Yes.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Larry Fox of the Values Group. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. And I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and Michael Ancuma with the Bank of America. And we're thrilled to introduce to you our final guest of the day. Her name is Myra Ruiz McPherson. She is the president and CEO of Ruiz McPherson Communications. So, Myra, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And tell us, what is Ruiz McPherson Communications?
We are a digital PR, social media engagement, and web application agency.
Oh, wait a minute. In the green room, you told me you were an anti-PR agency.
I know what I was about to say, but it's the anti-agency. The anti-agency basically is a more personalized service than the traditional agency model.
Okay, so the traditional agency model, if I'm buying PR,
yes.
What is that like for me?
I mean, generally speaking, that experience, very broadly, is it's either very high-end and unaffordable for most local small business types. And so what happens is that, I've been on the agency side so I can say this, they look for, you know, the big accounts or the big sexy projects. And if you're not, you know, 10 million above accounts, sometimes they don't call back or they're not interested, et cetera. So it leaves a whole market segment underserved.
So how do you treat me differently then?
Well, normally the type of customer or client that is gravitated towards us is a business owner, an entrepreneurial person that has either tried the big fancy agency and has had poor experience, or has tried smaller vendors and just trying to find the right fit for their business.
You had a very interesting example that you shared with us in the green room of a client. Tell us about it.
We're talking about the luxury pet resort.
Yes. Say that again. It's a luxury what?
It's a luxury pet resort, and we're talking
pet.
Yes,
like dogs
pet.
And cats and birds and
non-humans, right?
Okay.
furry, fuzzy things.
Tell us more.
Well, they're a wonderful client, and it's a family-owned, privately-owned business, And, you know, 10 years ago, they were the big hoopla. It was a revolutionary new thing. But now you drive around and see a lot of pet-related services all over the area. And so differentiation was an issue, branding. And then, of course, the way they market themselves is they like to say that, you know, they are the elite or quality, very premier service.
The Trump of.
Yes, pretty much. But at the same time, you know, given the market conditions, they don't want to come across as unaffordable.
So you help them tell their story is how you phrased it earlier.
Exactly.
Okay.
So
how long have you been doing this?
For that particular client?
The company. The company founded?
The company was founded in 2007.
And you had a huge staff at that time?
No, it was just, as I had shared, you know, me, myself, and I.
Okay. And that was really just 5 years ago. How big are you now?
Well, right now we're 20-plus staff members.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations on some fast growth.
And, you know, my team is local and international.
Okay. You described yourself as having, quote, these are your words, not mine, an addictive entrepreneurial spirit, end quote. What in the world does that mean?
Well, for me, what that means is that the ideas and the visions and the concepts just don't stop.
I'm going to ask you a somewhat different question. You are addicted to what?
I think it's the notion of doing something differently. Doing something very creative or coming up with a different twist on something mundane, making something ordinary extraordinary, it's very seductive to me.
It's telling the story. How long have you had that skill?
That's a really great question. I think I had it for a long time, but I didn't uncover it until, you know, pre-9/11, actually.
Well, tell us that story.
Interestingly, I got roped into a marketing department, and at the time that I was roped into that corporate marketing department, the vice president of marketing was let go, and their marketing manager, I guess, transitioned. And so there I was kind of holding a marketing department for a joint venture. I was roped into a bunch of public relation projects where communication and storytelling was key, and so I kind of, you know, realized at that moment that that was something I...
Learning under fire is pretty hard.
Yes.
Do you feel you had training for that, or you just had on-the-job training?
I think both. One of the stories we talked about earlier was, you know, back in the day when I would pretend to write stories for magazines. Well,
you were how old?
I was 15.
Yeah. And tell us that story, because I was expecting you to say
okay. Well, yeah, no, we want to take it further back, yes. My parents were divorced, so they often spent time shuffling me back and forth between residences. And whenever I would spend time with my dad, I really wasn't spending time with him because he was working a lot. So the only entertainment or company I had was a computer with a desktop publishing software on it. And I remember spending most of my summers, you know, creating fake magazines and pretending I was a newspaper reporter on a deadline. And so I learned the love of story and storytelling at that time, but I didn't know that it would be a formal part of my life then as it is now.
Where did you grow up?
I was born and raised in Puerto Rico, and I was there until 6 or 7 years old. My stepfather then he landed a job as an electrical engineer up here in Northern Virginia. And so my first experience to the mainland USA was Reston, Virginia.
You came here from Puerto Rico, and you're this exceptional storyteller. Language came easy, I guess, right?
Not at first. No, not at first. And probably one of the reasons it comes easy now, or it may seem so, is that I made a point to master your language, right? Because in the beginning, when I didn't have English and all I could speak was Spanish initially, I had to learn that to fit in and assimilate better.
Tell us about what that was like. Not speaking the language. Can you tell us a story about that?
Yeah, sure. You know, stories of, you know, trying to play in the neighborhood and not being understood, or going to school and being singled out for ESL when other kids didn't have to be pulled out. So that was a unique experience, and I always felt different or kind of not mainstream.
What did you do to master the language?
Wow. Well, part of that is humorously shared earlier was MTV came out at the time that I was trying to learn English, and so I fell in love with the music from Hall & Oates and REO Speedwagon and Pat Benatar at the time, and so those videos really helped for my my language to improve.
Not exactly the Queen's English, though.
No, not hardly. But hey, you know what? It worked, you know?
Well, did you study English or literature as you grew up? Or
not, you know, that's funny. No, not formally, but the love of words and language, I think I acquired, honestly, when I lived overseas. Because overseas, it was an experience that was very unique. You know, I came to the U.S. mainland area not speaking English. But then when we went overseas, the locals of those countries I was living in, they were dying to learn English. So, yes.
I just wanted to point something out. You've made it a point to say twice now, came to the U.S. mainland.
I know,
mainland. So is there a little geography lesson you just want to make sure everybody
sure.
knows?
You know, Puerto Rico, a little island in the Caribbean, you know. You have three types of people there. You know, diehards that will never come here, and then some that left, and then haven't gone back, and then the ones that go back and forth.
Yes, but Puerto Rico is what country again?
Yeah, of course, it's U.S. territory.
It's the United States of America, just as a reminder.
Yes, yes, yes.
You had mentioned that not too long ago, you tried an entrepreneurial venture that went south.
Yes,
but you bounced back. Could you share that experience?
Absolutely.
With us?
I, you know, my family and I, we had identified a real estate property that we thought we could flip, and we did flip it right before the market crashed. So, you know, we did well before that happened, and we thought, well, why don't we just, you know, use this money, you know, relocate, start a new life, new chapter. And so we ended up moving from Northern Virginia, Leesburg, of all places. We traveled all the way to Florida. It was West Palm Beach. We sourced a small business that we could buy. It was a store, a retail type situation. And I thought, you know, I have, you know, all this marketing and customer service, and I thought I knew what I was doing. And honestly, I bit much more than I could chew. And so that experience was probably one of the most humbling experiences of my life, because I pretty much lost all our family's profit from that flip. And we had to come back to Northern Virginia after 9 months with literally the clothes on our back. So to start over, you know, people think I'm sick or not well.
But you mentioned that the failure.
You know, it was probably as hard and painful as it was. It was probably the best thing that ever happened to me in my life.
What did you learn from that?
I learned to not love money. I learned to not be seduced by money, and just, you know, you learn in that experience when you lose everything, literally, that many other things have value. It sounds cheesy and corny, but it's so true. And when you walk those shoes, you know, I think it's also given me a very deep appreciation for working with business owners, because knowing that every single penny that they invest into their marketing is something that I honor. I know what that's like.
Would you give us the web address, please, for Ruiz sure. McPherson Communications?
Web address is RUIZ McPherson.com, RuizMcPherson.com.
If you could spell the whole thing for us, please.
RUIZMCPHERSON.com.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Myra Ruiz McPherson. She's the president and CEO of Ruiz McPherson Communications. I'd like to thank all of our guests today, including Mike Shelton, chairman of MCOR Government Services, Dudley Berthold, president, Griffin Technologies, Bruce Case, president, Case Design and Remodeling, and of course, most recently, Myra Ruiz McPherson, president and CEO of Ruiz McPherson Communications. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan Ingersoll & Rooney, and Michael Ankuma of the Bank of America for helping me with the interviews. More than anyone else, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. If it were not for you, we would not even have a radio show. So thank you very, very much for listening. A thank you to the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce for hosting us. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders just like Myra. And this is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. Again, saying thank you, and until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.